Hello and welcome to our Food Principles module on phenols, amines, salicylates, histamines, and sulfur. I'm super excited to be here to introduce you our special guest presenter today, who is going to share with you all of these aggravating food things that some people are sensitive to, and it makes for creating a really good diet for somebody difficult, because a lot of the foods that contain some of these things are actually like some of the really good foods we want them to eat. So Steph's going to clear up the confusion about this, explain what these different food chemicals are and where they're located and what people need to avoid if they have a problem and how to know if they have a problem and, you know, all the good stuff that we need to know about these. I want everybody to know that all the information that we're presenting here is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. If you decide to use this information to design and change your own diet, or when you're working with your clients, just to make sure that they know you're educating them, and if they're under the care of a physician, that you make sure that they take that into account and talk to their doctor about whether this kind of an approach would work for them. So I'm going to let Steph take it away from there.
I have this quote by William Shakespeare, whom I love. Our bodies are our gardens. Our wills are our gardeners. And I really believe that we can accomplish anything through focusing on eating real whole foods, even when it gets as confusing as this. So phenols. Let's talk about phenols. They include amines, which includes histamine. They include glutamate and salicylates. And we're going to talk about those different categories and what they are. But first, getting clear on phenols. So they're an organic compound with a hydroxyl group bound to a carbon atom that's part of an aromatic ring. And we're going to look at some pictures of them in a second. So an aromatic ring is a molecule with an odd number of double bonds in the carbon ring. So although they were initially named aromatic due to odor, some of them don't have an odor. So here we go. So this is what they look like. And so here are some phenols and what they look like. So tyrosine, serotonin, vanillin, methyl salicylate. So what do phenols do? They control enzyme activity in the plants that they're found in. They control the cell receptors in the plants. And this is all to protect plants. They can attract fruit-eating animals to spread the seeds. And they have antioxidant properties in our bodies when we take them in. They can be used for artificial colors and flavors and for natural colors as well. They can protect the plants from pests and overgrazing and sunshine. They're used by bacteria, so things like resveratrol, bacteria can make them into propionic acid, for example. So in our bodies, phenols require a well-functioning sulfation pathway, which is something we're going to talk about later in the presentation, and they must be broken down by something called phenol sulfotransferase, PST, enzyme. Okay, so here are some examples of phenols. So we've got benzene, BHT, hydroquinone, triclosan, like in those hand sanitizers, estradiol, salicylic acid, BPA, bisphenol A, and BPB, and whatever BP that they come up with next at the time of recording. These are the ones I know about. Naphthalene, like mothballs, tyrosine, serotonin, dopamine, histamine, tyramine. You know, so some of them have that convenient amine at the end, and you can recognize them. Yeah, and a lot of these things are things that our bodies are making, and some of them are things that our bodies don't really need. So we've got poison ivy, and we've got cannabinoids. Let's look at some phenols in plants. We've got resveratrol and tannins, catechins, and the ECGC in green tea, vanillin, again, which is in vanilla, other bioflavonoids, thymol, alkaloids that are in plants, and amines, glutamates, which can also be made by bacteria, salicylates, like in willow bark or in wintergreen. So you really can't avoid these things completely. They're ubiquitous in the plant world. Here are some examples from sort of common fruits and vegetables. So berries, anything that's darkly colored, citrus fruits, apples, peaches, apricots, plums, grapes, cherries. Interestingly here, I have pears listed as plant that contains phenols. And I also have it listed later in the presentation as a low histamine plant. And so it can get really, really difficult to customize a diet for somebody with these things, because these are the foods that really we want to be eating or be able to tolerate. The darker the fruit or vegetable, typically the more phenols are in there. You know, eating the seeds and the skins gives the most phenols, which of course are the more nutrient-dense parts of the fruit or plant. For example, resveratrol, like from the skin of the grapes. So again, any food colorings, even natural ones. So if things are colored with vegetable or fruit-based food colorings, that doesn't mean that they're going to work for all people. So this is what a reaction to a phenol may look like. So diarrhea, hyperactivity, or any kind of mood change, red cheeks and ears, sleep disturbances, hives or rashes, irritability, aggression, head banging or self-injury when it's extreme, headaches, some forms of seizures, joint pain, demyelinating issues. And so you're going to see these like in kids who can't communicate what's going on, right? And in adults too, but in adults you might see things more like, you know, migraines or neck pain or flushing or mood disturbances, things like that. All right, so those affected by phenols might include many children on the autism spectrum or with autism spectrum disorders, and they're typically low in something called sulfate, which we're going to talk about a little bit later and clarify. So they may be as low as like 15% of the sulfation ability compared to like a neurologically typical person. So if you're working with children who have autism spectrum disorders, it would be really great to be looking into the phenols and into their sulfation pathways. So those that are very low in sulfation might also include people with Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, or chemical sensitivities. And just a lot of people who just have weird, you know, food reactions or reactions to chemicals, and they don't really know what's going on. They can't find the pattern. This is often a component. Some phenol-sensitive people are also sensitive to sulfites, like stuff in dried fruit. You know, they might have dried fruit, and it might trigger a migraine for them or something like that. So keep note of anybody who's sensitive to sulfites, because that might be a clue that the sulfation pathway, which we're going to talk about in a bit, isn't working that well, and that they might be more susceptible to be sensitive to any of the phenols. So how does this happen? Again, phenol metabolism, so getting rid of the phenols in our body, requires sulfation. And sulfation requires a specific enzyme, something called PST, phenyl sulfotransferase. And poor sulfation can cause reactions to phenol. Okay, so we're going to go into some high phenol foods that we would typically eat. Berries, apricot, cherries, grapes, artichokes, rhubarb, red cabbage, those brightly colored foods, tomatoes, kale, parsley. And these are the lowest phenol foods that I could find, which, of course, they still have phenols, right? So pears, fruits without skins, so peel me a grape, green grapes, almonds, lemons, avocados, and melons. So a low phenol diet can help to improve symptoms and behaviors, you know, and if it's affecting somebody's ability to participate in learning or in real life or to develop relationships with others, it's really worth giving this a go. So it can dramatically help improve its symptoms. And it can also help with IBS and reduce gut pain. The connection between a lot of these phenol issues and with gut inflammation is huge. So there are a couple different diets to take a look at. There's something called the Feingold diet, which was created by Benjamin Feingold in the 70s. And it eliminated a lot of like the food additives that he believed were causing behavioral problems. He was a smart man. And you can check out feingold.org to learn more about this diet. Later, there was something developed called the Fail-Safe diet, which further reduced more salicylates and amines and even more additives along with MSG. So, yeah, these are great websites. You can go to failsafediet.com to learn more about this one. My personal preference is if I'm avoiding the phenols or if I'm working with someone to avoid the phenols, to check out the Fail-Safe diet. First of all, the website is really super clear, especially for parents who are reading it to get clear on what things are. They both eliminate a lot of what I want to call non-foods or junk foods and colors and additives. but the fail-safe diet eliminates a little bit more. And if they're willing to go this far, I like to eliminate more so that I can really help them to see a change and give them some hope. Yeah, so both of these are very focused on removing unnatural foods. So you'll have to customize something that works for your client. My guess is that your clients are kind of on the next level. I'm going to guess that they're probably not eating a lot of junk food if they're coming to you. So you may need to do, you know, more than what these websites even recommend. So here are some low phenol diet cons. So, it can be confusing, difficult to identify an intolerance when salicylates and amines and glutamates are all kind of involved. You know, people will think that they're sensitive to everything. And there's no lab tests to test for this, so it requires patience and doing a bit of an elimination and a trial, which is why I like to eliminate most stuff first and then add things back in those groups to see what the real sensitivities are at the time. Yeah, clients may have trouble identifying or articulating a reaction because there are, you know, neurological effects from this. And it adds another level of restriction to diet. This is a very restrictive situation here. The solution lies in our ability to process these phenols. Like, we're making them in our bodies and we're taking them in. So the diet is really great to help us to not take more in. But yeah, we still need a more long-term solution. Okay, salicylates. So let's talk about these. So they're a type of phenol, and again, they protect the plants that they're in. They can affect thyroid function. They can increase histamine sensitivity. They can make FODMAP reactions worse, right? So it gets a little muddy in there. Estrogens in medications or food can lower salicylate tolerance, and salicylates can activate mast cells in some people and release inflammatory substances, which again can worsen histamine reactions. And salicylate sensitivity can make, you know, digestive pain worse. An example of a salicylate, again, is methyl salicylate that's in wintergreen and like wintergreen essential oil, for instance. Here are some high salicylate foods. So again, berries, apples, grapes, tomato, almonds, honey, avocado, spinach, cantaloupe, watermelon, and dates. And these are foods that, you know, people who are doing their best to be healthy are going to already be including in their diet. So here are some high salicylate herbs. So it's possible to be sensitive to the salicylates and not the other groups of phenols. So really good to know, like, your herb chemistry, because your clients might be taking a lot of these herbs already when they come to you. So doing really good intake and asking them about stuff like herbal teas or what they like to put in their essential oil diffuser or their bath. Like, they may not even think about wintergreen essential oil or their meadowsweet tea when they're talking to you. So again, we've got meadowsweet, for instance, that they might find in Matula tea. We've got willow, which a lot of people do use, and birch and wintergreen, black cohosh, cramp bark, black haw. And so these herbs are becoming more and more popular. And you may find a client who is doing something for H. pylori and who's taking Matula tea and not realizing that it's aggravating their salicylate sensitivity. Okay, so on to amines. Okay, so these are a type of phenol, and they occur in some plant and animal foods. They're pretty high in fermented and aged foods, particularly the ones that are fermented with the help of yeasts. They're amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein, and it's sort of like when the proteins are being broken down by the bacteria and yeasts in these ferments that these amines get released. So this, of course, includes histamines, which can be released in bananas and chocolate, for instance, and glutamines, sauerkraut, and bone broth. Here are some high amine foods: bananas, cheese, chocolate and cocoa, wine and beer, soy sauce, natto, bone broth, hydrolyzed protein, stewed or cooked meat or aged meat, fermented foods, yogurt, sauerkraut, tempeh, even leftovers, you know, like things that have been made yesterday, are going to increase in histamine or other amine content over the time that they're stored, even in the fridge. Okay, what about histamine? So again, it's a type of amine. right? And it's released through the breakdown of foods, like we were talking about. But it's also created in our bodies. It's created by bacteria and yeasts, for example, H. pylori and candida and the other yeasts. And the reactions can be very hard to define, but can include dizziness, redness and rashes, allergic type reactions, headaches, fatigue. So the thing that categorizes this one in particular is when there's dizziness and when there's kind of like an instant reaction to food. So if someone sits down, has a bite of chocolate, stands up and feels dizzy, I'm thinking histamine in particular among the phenols. Here are some high histamine foods. So we got strawberries and kiwis, pineapple, bananas, walnuts and hazelnuts, wine, beer, soy milk, vinegar, spinach, eggplant, tomato, lentils, seafood. So looking at this list, when I was really sensitive to food, the only thing on this list that didn't bother me was lentils. But no one ever told me that I might have been having like a reaction to the amines in food. So the more you can look into this, the better for your clients, because they're really going to be looking for solutions and they're going to feel like, you know, their tolerances are super weird and nobody can help them. Here's some low histamine foods, really fresh. Like if they're going to eat meat or seafood, like it's got to be like really fresh. Watermelons and melons, again, peaches, pears and apples, mangoes, cherries, lemons, blueberries and blackberries, coconut water, any kind of coconut products, macadamia nuts as opposed to the other nuts, broccoli and seaweed. If they're going to choose a kale, choose the lacinato kale. Really, it's best to avoid all the amines if they're going to be avoiding histamines and any kind of leftovers. Like the stuff always, like it uses the same pathway in the body for us to get rid of it. And so if we're trying to reduce the reaction to histamines, we can really avoid all the amines and maybe make more traction. So this is getting crazy. So again, maybe best to avoid all the amines because they follow the same pathway. In an inflamed state, it's going to feel like everything is a no-no. It's just going to feel like, oh my gosh, I react to everything, right? So finding the patterns and being able to sort of sit down and talk through this with your clients so they kind of can understand what's happening and understand that this is not like a life sentence that they're going to have to be avoiding all food forever. Consider fasting or like mono meals. You know, you're going to have to work that out, what you think is safe with your client. But I couldn't help but put that in here because it's very difficult to avoid these if we're going to be eating foods. Again, another reason to really look at the root cause. Consider DAO. At time of recording, I cannot find DAO supplement that I would recommend. They all have kind of a lot of crap in them. The diamine oxidase, which breaks down these amines, including histamine, which people can take with their meals to help to reduce the amount of histamine that's coming into their bodies. But so if you can find a nice clean supplement, this can kind of help your client temporarily. You want to work on healing leaky gut and rebalancing or releasing histamine raising gut bugs and like the yeasts and H. pylori. You want to resolve sulfation issues and you want to be able to sleuth through the immune triggers and make sure they have a nutrient abundant diet, as abundant as it can be, right? And work on their healthy detox pathways. We need a lot of things. We need copper, iron, B12, B6, vitamin C, and healthy methylation to break down histamine. We're going to get this a little bit later in the presentation too. Here are some food and nutrients that can lower histamine. You can do a simple Google search as well, but you want to be aware that a lot of these foods also contain histamine. So it's going to have to be individualized for your client. One of my favorites is still moringa, which you can get as a powder, which can reduce up to 70% of histamine release in the body. Nettle, which does something similar but also contains a bit more histamine. Peppermint, turmeric, ginger, quercetin. Some people, you know, will take, you know, 500 milligrams of quercetin 3 times a day to help them with histamine issues. Vitamin C as well. Watercress and pea sprouts, mangosteen and black cumin, which have been found to help to stabilize the mast cells. So natural glutamate in plants and animals can be called L-glutamic acid. And an optimally functioning body slowly breaks this down, and it's delivered to the glutamate receptors in the body and in the brain in particular. in the factory. So we can break this down and make like this powder, you know, that looks like salt. So only free glutamate, aka MSG, is effective at enhancing the flavors of foods. Okay, so no matter what it's called, if it makes food taste like that, it's MSG. So there are a lot of new products that are coming on the market that are called like natural umami extract that are made with things like shiitake mushrooms and tomatoes. You know, but if we process those long enough and in the right way, we're basically making MSG. Okay, so it can be called yeast extract, calcium caseinate, beef flavoring, monopotassium glutamate, hydrolyzed anything, autolyzed anything, soy protein isolate, whey protein isolate. Protein isolate, not a good call. Natural flavors, malt extract. So really, it could be called anything, but these are the most common names. Here are some high glutamate foods. Okay, so MSG again, autolyzed yeast, again, soy sauce, Parmesan cheese, sauerkraut, bone broth, gelatin, peas, corn, tomatoes, mushrooms. We're just going to do a little quick recap on these diets here. So the Feingold and the Failsafe diet, talked about before, and then there's the low histamine diet. You can check out the Low Histamine Chef. It's a really good resource for clients. She's got a lot of recipes, and she's really not into the Band-Aid approach. She keeps doing research and adding content to her website. I have a lot of respect for her at time of recording. So that's a good resource for your clients. And there's like the low sulfur diet as well. We're going to get into the relationship between sulfate, oxalates, and phenols here for a second. So low sulfate levels can cause reactions to phenols because we need the sulfate to basically get rid of the phenols in our body. Poor sulfation can allow oxalates to get into the cells and affect the mitochondria. Okay, and oxalates can also kind of worsen histamine reactions because they're just like this, like, they're like a sharp, pointy thing floating around in our body that, you know, it's fair enough for our body to have a reaction to that, right? Low sulfate can lead to high oxalates, which can lead to depleted glutathione and oxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction. And as we're going to talk about later, we also need our ATP to be able to make sulfate and to get rid of these phenols. So it can be a little bit cyclic. So we're going to have to find a way to kind of throw a wrench in the wheel and stop this spirally pattern for our clients. Individuals with poor sulfation or low sulfate levels often do best with low phenol and low oxalate diets combined. Personally, I recommend not just jumping into a full low phenol, low oxalate diet. In my personal experience, I find it to be better if we're going to work on taking out the phenols to do that first, and then to slowly have a look at, you know, which oxalates they're eating and see if they're actually sensitive to it. I don't even bother taking that out if I don't have an oat test because I don't want them to have a dumping reaction. All right, so let's talk about the sulfur in more detail. So here are some sulfur issues that can affect phenol metabolism in our bodies. We need sulfate to detox the phenols. We may lose sulfate if we have low ATP. So we end up kind of peeing out more sulfate than we need to. We can't really resorb it if we have low ATP. We can't absorb sulfur compounds well in the digestive system if there's inflammation, right? And H. pylori actually can interfere with the sulfation of our digestive mucosa. H. pylori actually can't take hold in our stomach until they've kind of like desulfated our digestive mucosa in there, okay? So they don't like sulfur compounds, and they need to mess with that in order to take hold. So if you've got a client who you know is dealing with H. pylori, then there's something going on with the sulfur in the digestive system. And specifically, when the sulfate is removed from our mucosa, which the H. pylori likes to do, that's going to reduce our gastrin, so our digestive hormones, our stomach acid, our pancreatic enzymes, our immunity, like and so many things. It's just a cascading effect. Sulfites from our world, like from the dried fruit we were talking about, can build up and can add to this problem. So sulfate we need. Sulfite, not so good. Okay. We're going to talk about some relevant genes. So the sulfur transferase, the 1A1 and 1A3, they encode the PST enzyme that we were talking about before, which detoxes phenols and amines. Okay, and then we have this ABP1DAO gene, which encodes diamine oxidase, the DAO that we were talking about that, you know, a person can take in supplements, right? And so there's another gene that's just called DAO, and that's just a totally different thing. So this is the one that is relevant, you know, for histamine stuff, okay? And it breaks down the histamines and the amines. So this one, the sulfite oxidase enzyme, the SUOX gene, so this converts sulfite to sulfate, which is really the crux of this issue here. So sulfite equals symptoms. Sulfate equals we can get rid of these phenols. We're going to go over what a couple other things are here, and then I'm going to show you a little diagram to make this make a little more sense. Yeah. So 3-phosphoadenosine, 5-phosphosulfate, okay, PAPS. If you do some Google searching on this issue, this PAPS is going to come up. So it's a universal sulfate donor in our bodies. It requires ATP and magnesium. And we can only store a small amount of this, so we must synthesize it. You know, particularly if we're taking over-the-counter medications or whatever, we can use this up pretty quick. Okay, there's something called PST, phenyl sulfotransferase, which is one of the many sulfotransferases, okay? And it breaks down the phenols and the amines with the sulfates. And it also does this in the gut as well. So again, sulfates may be low in up to 90% of children with autism spectrum disorders. And this enzyme, the phenyl sulfotransferase, has been found to be low in 70% or more of children with autism spectrum disorders. So it looks like you can still have like a sulfur metabolism problem without having this enzyme be low, but I think there still needs to be a lot more study done. But these numbers are pretty big. They're really worth investigating. Some of these things can go other ways. This is like the relevant pathway that I really want to talk about first. So at the top, we have methylation, yada, 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 which is for another presentation. But so we've got methionine and cysteine, right? So food. And then the cysteine becomes cysteine sulfinic acid, okay, which then becomes sulfite. Okay, so we're making the sulfite. It's part of this pathway, but we can also take it in through preservatives and whitening agents, so like tapioca starch, cornstarch type deal. There are whitening agents used in a lot of these things that can contain sulfite, petroleum, canned foods. And the sulfite needs to become sulfate so that we can use that to get rid of all these phenols and these other fun things. But in order for that to happen, we need the sulfite oxidase, which requires molybdenum, B1, B2, and iron. It really does not benefit from mercury, lead, tungsten, and arsenic. Okay, so these things can interfere. I love to look for what's getting in the way, right? If things are not, if something's not working, you want to find what's getting in the way. So if this isn't working out, if you're not able to make traction, you made sure that your client has enough molybdenum and B vitamins and iron, it might be worth checking out, seeing if they have a history of mercury or lead toxicity or what's going on there. Seeing if they're eating a lot of tapioca starch, what's happening there. Okay, so once it's sulfate, then we need our ATP, and we make the PAPS that we were talking about before. And then we use the PST enzyme, which requires molybdenum and magnesium, particularly if your client is supplementing with P5P, by the way. And then we can, you know, detox these phenols and these amines, which, again, a lot of these things we're making in our own bodies. So this is like something that we need to be able to do anyway, even if we cut out all the phenols and the dried fruit that we're taking in from the world. We need to be working on this with our clients. So some help with sulfur. So again, the PST enzyme requires molybdenum and magnesium. We want to be able to convert sulfite to sulfate via sulfite oxidase. Okay, again, we need molybdenum, my favorite trace mineral, and B1 and B2. And you want to see, you know, ask about their fillings, ask about their history, about the heavy metals. So if things get stuck at the sulfite, yeah, we may react to sulfites, and we also may not be able to metabolize phenol. here are some hidden sulfite sources. So again, whitening agents and starches, preservatives in fresh seafood. Stuff gets sprayed on things that we buy in the store that is not necessarily disclosed. So if we don't know if something's fresh or if something should have gone bad but isn't bad yet, suspect something. Preservatives on grapes, just grapes, not necessarily wine, but even just grapes. Ingredients in wine production. Pickled and canned foods, particularly those that have been fermented and then basically killed so that they can be shelf stable, okay? Calcium or potassium bisulfite, calcium or potassium metabisulfite, burning coal, petroleum, pulp mills. So really getting into it with your client, like, do they live near a pulp mill? What do they do? What did their dad do for a living? Do they live near a gas station? Vehicle exhaust. So here are some symptoms and some suspect foods you can kind of use to help troubleshoot this a little bit. So if it's behavioral issues, you can suspect salicylates, amines, and glutamates. And, of course, you know, get the fake foods out of there. Mood issues and body pain together. You want to look at all the above plus oxalates in time. With physical symptoms like dark circles, red cheeks, diarrhea, incontinence, hives, eczema, or the more serious neurological issues like the stimming behaviors, right, where kids are spinning stuff or standing up and sitting down. You want to look at all of the above and dye and polysaccharides. So we're talking kind of SCD and GAPS. If they're having digestive pain along with this stuff, it's like everything plus FODMAPs. If they're having metabolic issues, you can look at oxalates as well. Again, if they're mentioning dizziness, have a look at histamine or other amines. So some food cravings troubleshooting, because we know that people often crave the foods that they don't tolerate or foods that are not broken down completely, because it can create kind of an addictive reaction in the body. So salicylates, if they're craving fruit and grapes and tomatoes and ketchup and apples. Amines, if they're craving bananas or chicken skin or bone broth, really kind of that salty food ferments. Glutamates, if they're craving soy sauce, Vegemite, Parmesan. Oxalates, if they're craving spinach and nuts. Gluten and casein, if they're craving wheat and dairy. That one's pretty clear. Yeah, let's go to reactions to fruit. No doubt this can be a bit confusing, right? And that's why we want to be looking at why it's happening rather than just getting stuck in avoiding all these things if you're freaking out right now. So if they're okay with eating berries or melons or oranges or nuts, but some other things, random things are not okay, check out FODMAPs first. If they can't have berries or melons or oranges or nuts, consider salicylates. So check out FODMAPs first before you check out all this stuff. If onions, garlic, and beans, and beets, and asparagus are not okay, again, check out the FODMAPs before you go down this road. But if strawberries, chocolate, sushi are not okay, consider histamines. If spinach or beets or nuts are not okay, consider oxalates. If beans and asparagus and beets are okay, consider salicylates. Okay, so you're going to have this chart, so you can kind of troubleshoot this yourself a little bit. If they can't tolerate any fruits, consider the lower no fructose diet, you know, which is really a version of FODMAPs again. So as much as I detest the FODMAP diet, I have to say I prefer it to the low phenol diet. So hopefully you can assess it that way, see if it's really a FODMAP issue, and then look at the phenol. Sulfur versus salicylate. If they're reacting to onions, broccoli, and cauliflower, right? So some people think that they have a sulfur issue, right? So we want to just know if it's sulfur or the salicylates. And it could, of course, be both, but they can have a reaction to salicylates that's independent of the sulfur issue. So if the red pepper, tomatoes, and almonds and avocado are okay, but cabbage, broccoli, and Brussels sprouts and eggs are not okay, sulfur. If red pepper, and it might be like just a headache. If red peppers, tomatoes, almonds, and avocado are not okay, but cabbage, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and eggs are okay, salicylates. Okay, and you can think about the other foods that, like, if your client is eating a vegan diet or like a raw diet, they might be having something called like kala namak. They might sprinkle that on their, I don't know, nut cheese, and then they might get a headache. So this is a clue. It's like a sulfur salt that we can use to pretend we're eating eggs sometimes. So here are some ingredients to avoid. You know, and this is just good sense, but it is something that we have to take the time to go over with people. Benzoate preservatives, BHT, BHA, natural flavor. They might be good, or it might be MSG, right? High fructose corn syrup, sugar, and all the relatives of that. Artificial colors and flavors. Artificial sweeteners. Splenda, aspartame, anything that comes in like a green or blue or pink package. Again, hydrolyzed vegetable protein. Flours. Fresh food that shouldn't look good anymore, but it still looks good. There's something wrong with this. Things in packages, right? So your clients are probably very educated about their health by the time they come and see you. But these issues are very important. And just finding out, like, are they using a lot of plastic water bottles? Like, what's going on here? Are they cooking their shiitake mushrooms to the point where they're making it more like a free glutamate? Helping your clients. This can seem overwhelming, and I like to consider this on a need-to-know basis. So giving your client like the helicopter perspective that these things are all connected and that there's an underlying, you know, issue that we're working on. And then beyond that, eliminating one food at a time. Some people like to use Epsom salts for sulfation issues. And personally, I don't really know if we absorb those through the skin. But I want to put that in here because that is something that people can do, and it's a nice self-care thing. You know, supporting children and families. This is especially difficult for families because, in essence, if we want to have success with our kids changing their diet like this, we can't have grapes lying around because a five-year-old, especially one with neurological issues, it's not fair if everybody else is eating grapes and they're not allowed. So supporting them with recipes, having Facebook recipe groups, sending them to the websites that we talked about here because they really are good at making it seem fun and inclusive and giving resources to people. Lists and charts and handouts, resources for eating out, and again, looking at the root cause. You want to address the following. So cellular metabolism, like we were talking about the ATP, the sulfation pathways, leaky gut, dysbiosis and fungal overgrowth, nutrient imbalances, oxalate load, but again, I would look at that separately from this, endogenous antioxidant production, unhealthy sources of phenols, amines, and salicylates, right? Cutting out that non-food stuff. Why? Again, sulfation. And prior to that, methylation. Toxins coming in. Too many things coming in, phenols coming in that we actually don't need in our bodies. Hidden toxins not going out. Immune imbalances, leaky gut, dysbiosis, right? So if you can work on those gut issues, and if you can work on the sulfation and the methylation, like these are really root cause things here. If you can see if, you know, they've got a mercury issue, or if they just have insufficient nutrients or trouble absorbing their nutrients, this is huge. You want to be able to reduce their symptoms in the moment, but work on the health of the whole body long term, right? Because sulfites are common. Phenols are everywhere, and they're in the good foods that we want our clients and their kids to be able to tolerate. Amines are important in our bodies, and sulfur is one of the most abundant minerals in our bodies, right? People may have a trickier time. Like, some people may have a trickier time with this than others, but you can really, really help these people with some patience and an eye on the big picture, because an understanding of these pathways is really important, and I can pretty much guarantee you they are not going to get this help anywhere else. They're not getting help anywhere else. That's why they've come to you. You know, so many kids medicated for behavioral issues and adults that are so lost in this confusing, it's just a really confusing thing when you just don't know what you can eat. You can really, really help people. So I encourage you to look deeper into this. We've got some references and resources here. Again, check out those websites that I was telling you about. Check out the Royal Prince Albert Amine Avoidance Handbook. You do have to pay for it, but it is good. And again, that's the fail-safe diet.